John Doe from Company X sent me an invoice today. He never does that. The sender, the subject, the greeting, everything is perfect, except I don't take invoices at my company.
Hello, Craig. Can you hear me?
Yes. Good morning, Andy.
I'd like always with our guests, Craig, to just get a bit about how you got into being where you are, what got you interested in tech early on, a little bit about how that's gone into your career and what you're doing now.
Sure. So I was a psychology major in college, a good student, but it took an enormous amount of effort to get good grades. So I was done with school and I went out into the workforce and tried a couple different things, but landed in cybersecurity at a firewall vendor before there was a World Wide Web. You know, the early days of the internet, and learned all the protocols and got into cybersecurity just over 30 years ago. But I always had that psychology background, and I found it really helpful to help convince people why security mattered, what the right thing to do was. If you understood human behavior, you could maybe help influence how they learned, what they learned, create a culture of cybersecurity. About 10 years ago, co-founded CyberHoot with some others. We took it basically the intersection of psychology, education, and cybersecurity to build CyberHoot, my company. And that was really interesting because at first we were struggling to build fake email, phish testing, attack. We call that attack phish. And it wasn't working and it was difficult and people weren't really changing their behaviors. And subsequent to, you know, this was 10 years ago, there have been two studies that have come out that have backed up our assertion that fake email phish testing doesn't work. And we do need to educate people on phishing, how it works, why it's so dangerous and clicking on things. But how you go about it, it can't be punishing and shame and, you know, focusing on the failure conditions. You actually have to take a different approach if you follow psychology. Behaviors that are rewarded are repeated. And that's really what we want to do in cybersecurity, but the industry as a whole sort of has tunnel vision on punishing clicks, right? And so about 5 years ago, we pivoted from punishing clicks with fake email phish testing, and we built a simulator that requires engagement. You get 100% compliance with your users because you know they've completed this interactive exercise that teaches them the six or seven pieces of the phishing puzzle, right? If you imagine phishing as a puzzle, there's six or seven parts of an email. When you construct them, you get a crystal clear picture of what a phishing attack can be. It's really a little bit of knowledge with a lot of common sense. And that's what we try to teach with this interactive phishing simulation. That was a really important pivot, but it was based on a multidisciplinary approach to cyber literacy education. It took psychological principles, educational principles, and cybersecurity principles and married them all together.
Which is where they belong. That's a natural intersection. And your first product then is a foray into email phishing and informed by psychology. You say, hold on, these filters or regular expressions or whatever technology was being used at the time didn't work because it wasn't psychologically informed.
Right.
And so what you brought to this, as you know, and including the education part now, is educational product. I take it you have an educational product. Is that run online? Is that something that you deliver in person or build into people's systems? I mean, say more about that.
Thanks, Andy. It's a SaaS platform, so software as a service. It lives online. We train and pay taxes in multiple countries around the world today. CyberHoot delivers assignments to the inboxes of users, whether it's a video. We produce 12 videos a year that look back on the previous attacks that have been out there, what's emerging as a threat. For example, this year in 2026, we'll have a deepfakes video. And what do you do within your company to protect your financials, your CFO, CTO, against, you know, someone calling up that sounds exactly like the CEO, CTO, whomever, saying we need to wire money over there. So we put a video together about that because that's an emerging threat. This year we did one on session token theft and the single click on even an unsubscribe link at the bottom of an email, the hacker can reach in and pull out your session token to your email, your bank, that sort of thing. But then we also cover the major topics. In addition to that, we send this Hootfish exercise. We call it Hootfish. It's a play on our company name, which is this interactive, you know, pick and choose safe or unsafe for these seven indicators. You pass the quiz and you've passed your phishing test. But it doesn't trick anyone, which is a psychological deterrent to engagement, right? If you trick people, they stop wanting to participate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And they get upset. And you can look, there's hundreds of Reddit threads on this problem. And, you know, empirical research says that method of sending fake messages and failing people and punishing and shaming them and having HR or manager meetings, mm-hmm. Oh, you clicked on a phishing link, you know, three and you're fired, is a major
no
problem.
Shit, this doesn't work. Yeah, having the cyber thought police breathing down your neck is not going to get you buy-in.
It doesn't. It actually is such a detriment in so many different ways, right, Andy? Just common sense tells you your IT department is supposed to be benefiting and empowering the users of your company or your mm-hmm. MSP, right, your managed service provider. But when they send these fake email messages, they're eroding goodwill, trust. When you shame and punish people, they don't tend to take responsibility for their mistakes or even want to do the remedial training, right? When you fail a fake email phishing test, what happens with most companies? They assign you a 30-minute video to teach you how never to make that same mistake again. And at Black Hat, August of this year, about 2 or 3 months ago, there were researchers that presented findings from their study on this very thing. They said the average person who failed a phishing test and was assigned a video spent no more than 10 seconds watching their training video to teach them how never to make the same mistake again. It just doesn't work. People are not in the frame of mind. They're not psychologically prepared to learn in the moments after failure. And there has to be a better way, which is what we've tried to produce, which is we send you an email that says, hey, Andy, here's your phishing simulation. It's a test, but it's interactive and it's open book. So if you don't know what typo squatted domain names are and what to look out for, just read this little bit of an explanation, right? The M in Microsoft might be turned into an R followed by an N to look like Microsoft, but it's R Microsoft, right? And that's what you got to watch out for, or a period in the wrong place and those sorts of things, all the way through to attachments as the final question. And we really find that people enjoy learning in this matter where they can pass a test, they get certificates of completion, their avatar grows in its ferocity, you know, as a gamification approach. All of this is designed to build engagement, but also knowledge. And if you really believe you can learn something, then you quickly internalize the knowledge and you repeat, rinse and repeat. It really does work.
Let's zoom in on our cohort a little bit more. What you're saying sounds internal B2B service from mm-hmm. your perspective. So internal, and this is coming to people who are in a work environment expecting something like that to come along. So the initial perception of it is something, now am I forced to engage with this? I'm encouraged to engage with this? Or is this something that I should just ignore? You know, there's an interesting tension here, isn't there? Because you're looking for engagement, but also you're teaching people not to be suckers, not right. to engage with things that might... So that initial entry point is a very interesting one already. How much compulsion, I'll just call them a boss. How much compulsion should a boss give to an employee, safe as far as the company's concerned?
You know, every single day, hundreds to thousands of businesses are breached with ransomware, business email compromise, or in the worst cases, those things have converted into a wire transfer of $100,000 or $1 million to the wrong person, and it's gone forever. Cybercrime as a industry was the third largest economy in the world last year. We're talking $10 to $12 trillion, depending on who you ask. That's only third to the United States GDP and China's GDP. So imagine that. Germany's entire GDP combined with Japan's was less than cybercrime.
Whenever I read money and cybercrime together, I kind of miss-see that, you know, like, is it a B or a T? Millions, billions or trillions? I don't know. I've lost track of the financial dimension of cybercrime. And when the Ross Anderson thing, cost of cybercrime, I mean, hold on, are you sure? And then the other staggering thing, of course, is that there's a point-to-point correlation with the disappearance of crime in reality. I mean, that's the real finding. That's big. As crime disappears from reality, it just goes online. Who would, you know, hang around on a street corner and sticking people up? The magnitude of it is horrific.
It really is.
And also the public visibility of it has for so long. I mean, I think it's about to crack. I think our profession is about to kind of go mainstream in the UK because our government bailed out Land Rover for $1 billion. I think it's like getting on for $2 billion now. Yeah.
Heard about the first $1 billion check. The inside scoop on that is that I think Land Rover and Jaguar, as you say, is a Tata company out of India. And Marks and Spencer was a Tata, at least it was tied indirectly through the venture capital firm Tata, I believe, that owned Marks and Spencer with another breach. The reality is these companies have done a very poor job of limiting the damage in those breaches, right? One would think that somebody of the size and scale of Range Rover would have hundreds, if not thousands, of enclaves or segmented networks. But what we're finding is it was a pretty big flat network. And so one mistake led to the sinking of the company, essentially like the Titanic, where, you know, it had these baffles between all of the Titanic ship had these segments throughout the ship to prevent it from sinking if it hit an iceberg. It was unsinkable when it launched, right? But the dumbest thing ever was they didn't cap those baffles. So when water got in, it just overflowed the top and it went to the next and the next and the next. And then it sank. And we know the history of that. Hmm. But when you build a network, whether it's a small company, mid-size or large company, if you don't put those segmented networks and have firewalls between, you know, finance and sales and marketing and support and yada, 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 then one mistake tanks the whole thing, right?
If you're building it from the ground up, if you get the luxury to build a new company, that's how you do it. You compartmentalize your info. Yep. A lot of those older companies are structurally ossified, and tech got built around them in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah? So, yes.
They don't structurally change then. And so they're a particular class of vulnerable old companies, right?
But you still have someone in charge of security there, right? I don't think Range Rover was of the size where they didn't have a CISO and 17 people helping with the day-to-day security of the organization. And you do a risk assessment when you take on a role like that, and you say, what are my risks? What's the likelihood, the impact, and the materiality to the business? Network segmentation is a huge risk. It's a high likelihood we're going to get a breach at some point in some position because we have such a large scope of employees and things. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to prioritize carving it up. Yeah. But, you know, I also agree with you and I empathize with the CISOs of the world, right? Their budgets are not what they need to be. I was a CISO at, you know, three or four different Fortune 500 companies. And, mm-hmm. you know, we had to do more with less. I think I went 5 years without a raise in one of my companies that I worked at. And we had a reduction in force two of those years. So we were always wanting more security be put in place, but we had to do it with less people, less money, less time. And, you know, automation was a key there. Making sure that the processes we built were automatic, not manually driven. But you're right, it can be a really tall order in some scenarios to retrofit things, especially when you've inherited a lot of what we call technical debt, right?
Bless them. I don't know why. I like Land Rovers. So they're kind of, if I had a vehicle, be a Land Rover. I don't have a vehicle. I don't drive. I felt really sad that they got hacked. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Helen and I are chatting about whether or not the government would, this is before it happened, could this happen? Could the government actually bail out a company like that? And we said, well, no, don't be silly. Lo and behold, surely, you know, a slippery slope. Isn't that just a green flag of encouragement to attackers?
It depends on whether the bailout was to pay the ransom or to help recover the infrastructure that needed to be rejiggered or redeployed.
I didn't think it was a ransomware attack. I understood it was a wiper attack. I thought they just got wiped out.
Yeah, I don't know the details. Was it a wiper where they destroyed all
No, I have heard that it was a very destructive attack and it wasn't intended to be ransomed. It was designed to take them down.
I'm asking a bot now, what is the background on the Land Rover breach?
The motives.
What's interesting is you can predict who the attackers were based on the outcome of the attack, right? If it was a ransomware event and there was the threat of disclosure of information, destruction of information, that sort of thing, and money was at play, you might think organized crime or a nation state that does money laundering like North Korea through their hacking activities, or perhaps it was, Iran. But if it was to just destroy things, that could be any nation state seeking a global advantage, right? Nation states get involved in this stuff all the time. Unless we can determine that, or it becomes, right now they're probably in the throes of, you know, gag orders and legal, you know, legal protections. They've lawyered up and no one can talk about anything publicly. So we won't know for months and months.
And in a sense, it's irrelevant. I think the way I wrote it once was, if you've got a knife sticking out of your chest, who put it there is not important. The important thing is that you've got a knife wound to deal with and you could sort that out.
Yeah.
There's people that immediately jump to attribution. It's a suspect to me because attribution engineering toolkit, the whole thing is designed to misdirect. So the purpose of your hack isn't actually to even do the damage, it's to make someone think the SUT did.
Right.
And so that's kind of another level up in InfoWar and especially in the sort of geopolitical context. I thought that it was going to get pinned on environmentalists, activists with a kind of green agenda. Whoever did a good job on a wiper will make sure there's no logs anywhere. You know, there is no attribution. And I think that probably still can be done by clever people.
Right. I'm getting slow bits of information from AI saying that, you know, it was announced at JLR, Jaguar Land Rover, in September that their systems were impacted. Then the disruption was more severe with production lines shutting down in all their major UK plants. And the company said some data has been affected. The interruption expected to last many, many weeks. Hacker claiming affiliation with groups such as Lapsus and Shiny Hunters and Scattered Spider are claiming responsibility for the attack. And, you know, some reports on losses run in the tens of millions of pounds per week. In terms of a root cause, it's not exact that anyone has come, nothing's been publicly confirmed. Was it ransomware, data exfiltration, supply chain compromise? Was it a hacktivist?
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
We do training in our videos. Our very first video, Andy, in our CyberWho platform talks about five kinds of hackers. You've got a script kiddie, they buy their tools, they run them, they're looking for more notoriety and, you know, bragging rights within their friend circles. You have organized crime that has really moved from physical crimes, to your point earlier in the conversation, to online crimes, because it's so much easier not to get caught in the electronic space. Right?
Yeah.
You just have to be smart about how you attack. And if you think about this logically, let's break into a computer in China, then jump to a computer in Russia, and then do our attack on some Western business. Because if I have to track it back to you, I have to go figure out who in Russia I can talk to and how do I get the logs on those servers. And then it points to China. And then I go to China and I'm like, well, somebody broke in there, but it's still not the source. The source could be South Africa. It could be North Korea. It could be US. It could be wherever in the world. you can't follow it back, right? But if you're smuggling booze from, you know, point A to point B, there's 75 camera phones that could take a snapshot of this truck full of booze. And when you're unloading it, when you're loading it, when you're driving it, when people are drinking, like, where did this come from? It's a lot harder to do physical crimes today than ever before. But electronic crimes, oh my gosh, it's a field day right now.
I think we need maybe not a new taxonomy, but maybe we need to just shake it up and chat about that. We've had this kind of motive cluster, the ideas or models of guy behind the black hoodie is, you know, and there's a mythology mass media buys into. So what you end up with, I think, is a difficulty in actually communicating motives, because first of all, motives are really complex. And always surprised to hear guests talk about something and then they say, oh, but it was an insider job all along. And actually those guys were working together. So, oh, of course they were, you know. And then you can kind of see how motives in cyber are pretty weird and difficult to spot. But once you spotted that pattern, then you can defend against it, right? But you don't see them coming sometimes, yeah.
I would push back on that principle just a little bit to say that we do incident response. We have a virtual CISO offering here. And I would say in almost every case that I've been a part of, it's been financial motivation. You know, they talk about the evolution of ransomware and extortion. They're going to not double extortion, but triple extortion now. They used to just encrypt your data and demand a ransom, but good backups would recover you from that demand. Now they exfiltrate the data and try to delete your backups while they're in your network before they execute the ransomware. So they can either extort you for not getting your data back or releasing that sensitive data to the public. And then triple extortion that we're seeing some places are if you don't announce your breach to the authorities, as is the law of the land in so many industries such as healthcare, finance, then we'll report you to the FTC or the HIPAA, you know, authorities. You'll get fined for not responding and reporting this in time, because you have a finite window for reporting breaches. So there's that third thing. Mischievous and devious and absolutely underhanded.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
The answer to all of this is preparedness and resilience. You've got to be prepared with network segmentation, with EDR solutions, with awareness training, phishing simulations that don't ostracize or alienate your employees, all part of a robust defense in depth program. So that you can try your very best to avoid these things and discover them when they happen quickly and limit the damage if they happen. The FBI has a classic quote, which maybe everyone in the world has heard by now, but they said there are two kinds of companies in this world. Those that know they've been breached and those that don't know they've been breached. So as a security personnel, if you're listening to this, you have to work off the assumption that you will be breached. And how do you limit the damage? How do you recover quickly? How do you discover it before it spreads and makes worse things? Mm-hmm. And how do you make yourself more resilient? Like, you know, in the physical world, if you put lights outside your house and you have a guard dog and a fence around it and camera surveillance, guess what? They're not going to rob your houses first. They're going to go to the house that's down the street that's dark, has no fence, no dog, and the window's partly open, you know?
Oh, that's where the crazy guy with the machete lives.
Yeah, that's right. He's like, come on in, please.
Well, you're painting a picture that's so bleak. Who'd want to be in a business right now with the dogs outside your door and the no one to call, can't call Ghostbusters? What happens, I think, is we say all of this, and so you need this, you need to be prepared, you know, you need resilience, you need a backup plan, you need defense in depth, you need to think about your infosec. And you say, I haven't got time for that. I have not got time for that. I got a business to run, okay? Yeah. And it's really hard to turn a business around because it works in a certain way. It's a machine. It works in a particular way. in a way, with tech, we've walked into an ambush. It's a bit of a, you know, we're suddenly caught out in the open and there's movement on the tree line everywhere. And what do? We've stumbled into something bad with the way that we've allowed IT to overtake so many processes so fast, and to not merely complement them, facilitate them, but to dominate them and to become them. So mm-hmm. that we're in a situation where your psychologist, right, responses, fight, flight, or freeze. And I think a lot of CEOs, a lot of businesses are freezing right now.
Yes, they are. Yeah, you're not wrong. But there's, okay, this is all dark doom and gloom, but let's talk about some of the positives and the good stuff. Many good things are happening in the world to make this more difficult. I'll give you one example, Andy, and I hope you don't mind the segue, but passwords have been the second leading cause of breaches in the past. Most often the biggest cause is a social engineering attack delivered via phishing emails or voice or SMS. You've all gotten the toll violation, you know, pay this toll or else on your phone, or even QR codes when you go to pay for parking somewhere and there's a sticker on the QR code. Those are all social engineering attempts. But passwords have been a real nuisance for better part of 3 decades. Pass keys, that's a great increase in security. Can't be stolen. When you have a pass key between your workstation and some website out there, if that website's breached or someone steals those pass keys, they don't work anywhere else. No intelligence can be gained from them, as opposed to a password that was maybe not hashed properly. And I could see what your root password was. And oh, you're going into Google and I see dash Google on the end of your password. Let me try logging into your bank dash bank name. And guess what I'm in? Oh, great. I love it. The awareness training and phishing that we're doing, if we can move people away from punishment towards positive reinforcement, then it makes the experience of cyber literacy training more enjoyable.
That's what I want to focus on today, Craig, because I think that's a very, very valuable and insightful direction. I think we all see things from different spheres of interest. And thinking in purely in terms of security, there's a huge lot of hope to be had for more secure systems from things like, say, passkeys. But then we look at it from, you know, multiple spheres of interest. And so then you go to usability and you go to privacy rights, things like age, like young people and old people. Most tech doesn't account for about 30-something% of the population. That one sigma in the middle of the bell curve, and if you're outside that, you're done in many designs and many policies and so on. So what we often find is that, yeah, it's great in one area, but it's not working out in another one there. So the one thing that we can clearly agree on is that forewarned is forearmed, and knowledge is a very powerful tool in a defensive capacity. Knowledge, but knowing how the thing that you're using works, that it is a tool, and in the sense of Neil Postman, we're between a tool using society and a technocracy, not yet a technopoly, but nearly a technocracy. But most of us are tool using animals. We go and we pick up a tablet or a phone or go to a keyboard with a task in mind, with an objective in mind, and we use that device to achieve an objective. And people are using tools to produce value. That sort of bedrock of capitalism hasn't gone away. But if you don't know how to use those tools, if you become ignorant of them, of the traditions that are handed down, it's kind of weird to think of technology culture as being old enough. I mean, that's modern digital technology, but we're still tool-using creatures, and that doesn't go away. What becomes a problem is when we don't know how they work anymore. We don't know how the materials, what are the materials that we're working on, and why we're working them in that way. And we don't know what the tools really do. Everything's kind of become magic. So to me, education is absolutely vital, is to bring people a bit back down to earth about what technology is and how it should function for you safely, for you and for others. Yeah,
you're so right. My first thought on that whole line of reasoning is that for years as a cybersecurity professional, and you've probably heard this and said this as well, Andy, we want to be brought into the table on these major technology projects early on to provide guidance to, you know, the appropriate way to achieve your objective. Because oftentimes, and this happened just yesterday, I was on a call, I was given 24 hours notice, a company was adopting a new AI model to process tax return forms. And the MSP said, hey, Craig, your company is the cybersecurity consultant to this business. And they're an accounting firm doing taxes. And they're adopting this AI solution. And I don't think security was involved in any of the conversations. So I had 24 hours to turn around a bunch of questions for the vendor to say, oh, public or private LLM? Are you consuming any of the critical data from these forms you're ingesting, or are you just processing them in a non-consumptionable way?
And you've got to be a lawyer as well. I mean, you're, you know, you're suddenly putting on lots of hats there because this is absolutely fresh ground for questions, I think.
Exactly right. What's the privacy policy of the firm? Do they have any certification, SOC or ISO or something else, to say that they know what they're doing? Because there's literally thousands of AI firms starting up every day, all with some great ideas, but they could be gone tomorrow. They could have no security whatsoever. They're rushed to market, be first to market to corner something. There's a lot of risk involved here. So we did the questions, we got the answers, and actually there were better answers than what we were fearful we might hear. And the firm that was doing this project had pretty good answers to most of the questions. So it all worked out in the end.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
The point I was raising initially is that we have for years said, ask cyber to be at the table to begin the conversations on these tech projects so that we can guide you. Because you get too far down the wrong path, it's difficult to go backtrack and make a better choice and fix things. But there's another avenue that I think we need to add to that, Andy, and you were alluding to it. You can't just be the cyber guy at the table. You have to also be the psychologist and the cyber guy. If you go back in history, there were some really smart mathematicians who said, you know, the strongest password is 9 characters, uppercase, lowercase, special characters, numbers, and you need to change it every 90 days because that's about the time it would take to brute force such a password. But that's what you all have to adopt. But they forgot the human psychology of a brain can't remember 3 passwords of that level of length and complexity. And then when you change them every 90 days, people just cheat and the results are really bad password hygiene. Advance 20 years from 2003, that was the NIST standard, National Institute of Standards and Technology. In 2017, they said, well, we got it wrong. We don't know really what it should be, but it should be longer. And maybe we shouldn't have the complexity because then, and maybe we shouldn't reset it every 90 days either. Let people choose a really good, long and strong passphrase. Maybe put it in a password manager. That would be a good idea. Tie it to MFA. And then they just now, 2025, they literally just published their final standard on this. And that's what they said, you know, 15 character passwords in a password manager, pass keys when you can, multi-factor when you can't, don't use SMS for multi-factor, etc.
And that's just a snapshot. I mean, that's great for today. We're in difficult territory because moving, and at a hell of a rate as well, things change. The advice on passwords was never technically, and it's never mathematically sound in many ways. It's a great exercise to do with students, is doing the exponentiation and working out what's the effect combinatorically of adding more digits than using a bigger alphabet. And you can see how those two grow. And it's, actually, if I just add more digits, it's massively more effective. But for all of this time, we've had these... And it hasn't stopped. And it hasn't stopped because I don't think the memo about NIST has got out at all. So many systems are taking... They're taking a model and they're enforcing that model in an authoritarian way.
Right.
And what it does is it causes risks. It doesn't fit the use case. So here's a couple that I've encountered in the last couple of days. Mom was setting up a computer for a kid who's 9 and already has a password. Commodore. Re-released the Commodore 64. The trademark was bought by some cool retro hacker. Mini ITX motherboard in it. Got its own little brew of Linux. Emulates the C64. And it's packed with games and emulators. So I got one for my kit.
Wow.
Come to set the password. And it's still got like the kind of old, yeah, you can't have that password, mate. Sorry.
8 characters, right? Some of the Linux distros didn't support length.
It wouldn't let me put in the one that I had. I could not put it. Pre-decided I was going to use such a password to make it compatible. Game over. It's like it basically broke my workflow and made me do something much less secure.
Yeah. Yeah, we do that. We see that a lot of times when we go through audits and an auditor comes in and says, show me that you've changed your passwords in the last 90 days. And we say, we don't do that here. And they go, oh, well, that's a failure point. I said, no, it isn't. Our passwords are 15 characters where technically possible. They're stored in a password manager. They're tied to MFA. You show me where any control that says that's not sufficient today. And I go to bat with these against these auditors because their instruction set is outdated. They need to patch their instruction set for auditing, but they haven't. And truthfully, the same, just to go back to your earlier point, the same happens with fake email phish testing, right? Everybody says you have to go and send these attack messages to your employees to cover off on the threat and scourge of phishing. That doesn't work either. And the psychology of it is all wrong. Just like the psychology of 9 character passwords that you change every 90 days. That was wrong. You need a multidisciplinary approach in cybersecurity.
www.cybershot.uk.
You need a multidisciplinary approach in cybersecurity. And I say multidisciplinary, I don't stop at psychology. You need the financial side of the house too. There's a lot of cybersecurity people who are well-intentioned who would spend millions of dollars to secure, you know, your training records that don't have almost any NPPI, non-public personal information, versus, you know, your banking information. Sure, you could spend more on that, but you don't need to do, it's all relative, and you need to have a financially, fiscally responsible approach to cybersecurity just as much as you need a psychology approach, as much as you need the bits and bytes of cybersecurity as well.
Yeah, well said. What I picked out of that was multidisciplinary. My wife worked in mental health in London, and you have to work with doctors, psychiatrists, home visiting teams, with the police, with social services, to work with carers, family, to work, you know, and all of these people are represented, and they have weekly MD, multidisciplinary team meetings, reflective practice. They all get to talk to each other about, like, well, why your idea doesn't work here, and this, what's, you know, but why don't we try this? And it's a form of organizational democracy that I don't think exists in tech. They haven't really got into these sorts of ideas, but for multidisciplinary and reflective practice and so on. Education. Or let's just stop calling it education, sort of dissemination of intelligence within the organization about what are threats and how to deal with them. And that sort of sets the company's security posture. For some companies, that can be very easy. It can be really chill. They don't have a lot of assets to protect. We're in a really interesting position in cybersecurity, because if we have to start thinking, well, security for who? Security for who, security from who or what, and security to what end? What is the vision that you've got? And often it's a conservative practice. We just want to hang on to what we've got and make sure that no one nicks it or screws it up for us. Education in cybersecurity has very broad implications. it's something we should start in schools, like at 5 years old, a sort of a completely new wave of digital literacy. I think that's happening because of the way that smartphones are interacting with families. There's a bit of a sea change going on in how we all think about cybersecurity.
You said your wife worked in mental health, and mental health, you'll know, is very underreported in terms of what people tell publicly about their mental health state, if they're depressed or if they're, you know, have other feelings. People don't want to hear about it, or there's a stigma associated with mentioning any mental health issues. Cyber breaches are the same thing. What we hear about with Range Rover is a small fraction of what's actually happening out there. So people think, oh, I might be too small to be attacked. I might have nothing of value to be stolen. All of that couldn't be further from the truth. You don't get to a $12 trillion industry by only attacking Land Rover. That's $1 billion. There's, you know, 10,000 other companies that have been breached, 100,000 for a lot less, and they're production and their operations interrupted for days and weeks. And look, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, there was another firm where they had a password breach and it led to their demise. 158-year-old UK business. I think they were in the uniform cleaning business. I could be wrong about that, but it was 158 years old. And it was breached and they had to shut down. 700 people lost their jobs because they couldn't recover from their breach. Mm-hmm. This is happening and we're not hearing about it because, just like mental health, there's a stigma associated with coming clean that you were breached. You know, people don't want to embarrass their company or lose the goodwill that they've built with their customers and their loyalty. But at the end of the day, unless we are 100% clear how often this happens, who it happens to, which is everyone, now, how often is every day, people don't take the ounce of prevention they need to for the pound of cure that they're going to pay down the road.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
Because this had happened in London very spontaneously, and it happened around the arts hacker scene of, you know, people would go to program in Lisp and Python and Pure Data, whatever, we'd make music, you know, and we'd play the music and we'd have VJs. And out of that came crypto party kind of scene, which was a more security aware, privacy awareness, and more sort of social technology awareness. And it was very easy to get people together and talk about it.
If you take a multidisciplinary approach and you make it enjoyable, you make the gamification of your education program front and center. I have seen many companies create a culture of cybersecurity where it's second nature that you don't do this or you don't do that, or you report something when you see something, and you're aware of, you know, the social attacks that occur. There's a channel that's been created in your Slack or in your Teams where any employee can post a question. Hey, is this look like a fish to you? Yeah. I think it is. And other people will chime in. Yeah, look at the typo squatted domain. See that period between this and that? That's a definite attack. You need to delete that and report it to IT. And so that culture builds and people are rewarded for doing the right thing.
Let's stay with that, because that's one of your key messages, and I like this. People are rewarded for the build. You found a way to build esprit de corps, at least in at the level of the security of the firm.
Yeah, right?
And because obviously, if we get hacked, I lose my job. But yes, I'm in it, so here's some buy-in. Right? And you know, you can lose your job because you're not secure. Even that recognition. I am a dependent and depending part of a larger group. This is a relational discussion now, and it's about power relationships, it's about pay, it's about status, it's about so many things that happen inside an organization or a culture. I think what we often see, the things that bring bad security are already structurally there. There's already something bad going on, right? Mm-hmm. So if there's an abusive power relationship within an organization, then things are not going to get reported up or whatever. Building this very positive culture that you describe must often require, you know, taking on some really big structural challenges inside the company.
Yeah, it does, but it you don't have to solve. There's an old English phrase, I think, because it was Rome wasn't built in a day. It takes a little bit of effort to start recognizing when people do the right thing. It takes adopting tools that don't punish right out of the gate, right? How many times have we all heard of an IT team or a CISO who comes into an organization and says, I want to run a fake email baseline fish test. I want to get the number of people that fail this test so I can get my baseline. And, you know, we haven't trained anybody, but I just need to know how many people are doing bad things. And then they fail everyone, and then it leaves a bad taste in their mouth, right? And then they don't want to participate and report things when they see things because they don't want to look stupid because they haven't ever been taught properly. You take that and you throw that out. You put in a position of, you know, our CyberHoop product sends a notification that says, Andy, here's your phishing test. It's not a trick. You need to go and analyze this email, and we have open book. We teach you what you need to know while you're doing it. You learn the rubric. And oh, by the way, this helps you personally as well. This is not a cost of doing business exercise. This is a benefit we give you to teach you cyber literacy skills that you need in your household at home. You can share with your wife and your kids. And by the way, you know, like, it's a benefit. It's a good thing for you to learn and understand cyber literacy for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way to put the sweetener. I mean, that it's a portable skill. People are suspicious when more work is loaded onto them at work, mm-hmm. and yep. it's clearly in the interest of the company. And it's, hey, well, what am I getting out of this? You know, I'm getting more work, more compliance, more things to think about. Shouldn't you guys be thinking about that? Like, and I have heard arguments, you know, and this is taking it to an extreme. If you're requiring to train your staff in a company to avoid cyber problems, you've already failed in your IT system. They should never be getting through it, which is the kind of complete sort of preventionist perimeter type mentality.
Poppycock.
It is. It's total BS, and it's an absurd position because you have no idea what a perimeter even is now.
Right. Yeah. And well, your humans are inside your business. Yeah. Humans are the cause of 90% of breaches. No matter the technology, they get email on their workstation every day. I mean, yes, I would fault you if you gave every employee administrative rights, and you all know who you are out there that didn't remove those from your end users in your business. Do that today. Because one mistake by that gives the rights to a hacker to install whatever they want. And then they're in there landing and expanding and moving laterally. And then they're seeing, is there segmentation here? Where are the backups? Can I delete them? Can I not? It gets a slippery slope. But humans will always be the weakest link. And you can put as much technology in place as you want. The only thing you could do to say to protect a piece of data is to put it in a bank vault in that seed vault in the, you know, Arctic Circle of Norway, I think, and no one can get to it. Zero availability. Otherwise, humans, and even in that case, someone's going to break in and steal it if it's valuable enough.
What do you think are the most virtuous, rewarding cycles that somebody can get into in their workflow? Because what I'm thinking is if you're performing well in security, nobody notices. It's one of those things that people only notice when you fail. We have that in sound engineering. If you're a great sound designer or whatever, someone will watch through the entire film and not notice the sound design. So
yeah.
your success is to not be noticed.
Yeah, that's interesting. And almost every industry has some version of that, right? An MSP, managed service provider, when they keep the equipment up and running well and there's no major outages, people, the owners of companies start to question, why are you charging me so much money to keep things running? It can't be that hard. Everything's just working every day. Yeah. Well, you don't know just how much effort goes into making sure that things just work every day. And when there is a blip that we fail over to a secondary system and you don't even notice the failure, right? But in cybersecurity, I think the way around that is to not keep it in the dark, not keep people in the dark. When you do educational videos on emerging threats, and when you create a Slack channel or a Teams channel and you ask your employees, hey, if you see something, say something here. And it doesn't have to be the IT person that confirms it. It can be another employee. And then if the two of you or the five of you aren't sure, then go to IT, but make it everyone's job, right? Cybersecurity is not the responsibility of the IT director or manager. It's the responsibility of the CEO and the CFO and the board of directors and every employee, because you all could be the one that introduce a problem or report a problem before it becomes an issue. And so the more you can make it everyone's sort of background noise of their lives and their technology work that they do, that, hey, cyber is part of everyone's job every day.
Yeah.
That's create, and then reward people when they do the right thing. That little bit of reward creates a culture of, there's no embarrassment for reporting something, even if you make a mistake. It's always better to say, is this an issue? Find out it isn't, and be okay. Well, at least you told us about it. We couldn't have advised you otherwise.
It's not the normal culture inside a corporation in which people are competing with each other. Now, we have a saying of Aesop or Greek, okay, small enemies unite against a common foe. These are very important perspectives. Mm-hmm. You know, we could get into the negative sides of the psychology of otherism and all of this sort of thing, but like that, they're important constructs. We're in it together against the other, them, where this abstract thing is just some random threat. But just that posture to begin with means that you must cooperate together to fight. Mm-hmm. And in so many corporate cultures now, people are already at each other's throats. That there's a lot of work to be done in breaking that down, right?
There was a wise person talked about salespeople, and they said, show me the incentives and I'll tell you what the behaviors they're doing are. Whatever you incentivize will drive behaviors in your company. So if you have a company and you don't have a culture of reporting, assisting one another, you simply have to put the people in charge of rewarding and creating a feedback mechanism that recognizes those things, those behaviors you want to see more of. Reward an individual for adding a potential phishing email to a Slack channel. And then you do a luncheon drawing once a month to say, hey, from all the people who reported a fish, whether they were right or wrong, they just reported one. Here's your free lunch.
I'm just going to come at this to sort of look at its weaknesses a little bit, because that I think in a way, a behaviorist approach, first of all, is measurable. I mean, mm-hmm. you can set out what you want to see, and then you can measure whether or not you get that, which is appeals a lot to people who are thinking into financial terms, right? Because they won't do anything unless they can see numbers to measure it, and they literally won't move without numbers. So that unfortunately excludes the entire qualitative perspective, which, you know, may or may not be more or less important than getting the compliance on the immediate issues you want. And there are two reasons why that might not be good. One is, as I said, that you're in a very fast moving landscape. So the behaviors that you desire might need to change quite rapidly. And so my question is the big question at the moment with AI, isn't it? Is behavior the same as understanding? And I kind of posit that there's something else that's deeper that you can go for, which is that everybody in the team understands they're not just being kind of, if you like, indoctrinated into behaviors. And the reason that that's better is that they're able to make decisions autonomously, which are much more powerful decisions. Otherwise, whoever comes with so we say policy without politics, comes with a certain set of values which are in that moment. That's not quite the same as building a crew who are threat aware on a more canny level.
You do have to come at this from a position of, going back to multidisciplinary, there are clear ways that educators teach materials, right? There's a complicated study or author who wrote Bloom's Taxonomy.
Watch one, do one, teach one.
Yeah, right. And it's a series of depth chart on what level of understanding did you get to, right? A really smart person said to me once, if you want to really understand this topic, teach it to other people. If you have to break it down into its components and then explain it to others, you're going to have a much deeper understanding of it. Going back to that fake email phishing and the huge number of problems with it, one of them is that when you fail people in an exercise that doesn't actually educate them, it only measures what they already know. And when you fail people, they give up responsibility in learning, in playing a role. I was talking to a really brilliant gentleman about 6 months ago, and he said, you know what, Craig, those fake email phishing tests, they've really pissed or upset me. I'm really mad. Yeah. I don't even try to figure it out anymore. I've failed one too many times. So now all I do is I send everything to IT. If I don't know and I can't easily tell and I don't really have a good rubric because no one ever taught me, they just failed me, I just send it all to IT and let them make the decision for me. And that independence of thought is lost on that person. They haven't made the investment to learn some very simple knowledge pieces around how to spot and avoid phishing because they've been punished. You need to create a culture that is rewarding good behaviors, but also teaches the raw materials that people need to make those independent decisions in a way that they want to engage with. There are better ways to do things. That's one of the foundational differentiators of my company is the psychology behind it. You know, just sharing enough of an insight with a user that they go, I get this now. I understand a typo squad, a domain name. Why didn't anybody explain that to me before? Because I've been struggling my entire professional career with reading these damn domain names. I didn't know how to do it. Now I do. I can get this. I can learn this. I can understand and participate. So how you go about it really does matter. And teaching that raw material, the raw knowledge, and getting the engagement, making it a game, not using punishment for anything, will really help change that culture over time.
People are working in company time and they're doing training and on the clock, they're being paid. It must be cost effective for the employer to make that happen.
Oh, absolutely. It's less than a cup of coffee a month per employee. If you try to do it in a single 75-minute session or 50-minute session once a year, you've lost the battle. People's attention spans are much shorter than that today. You need to do what in the physical fitness industry is called HIIT, high intensity interval training. Short periods of like 30 seconds to a minute, you know, four times a week has enormous effect on your cardiovascular health, your fitness, your strength, all of those things, just with the shortest, tiniest little investment in time, but it has to be high intensity. Likewise, in our trainings at CyberHoot, we do 3 2-minute videos, one video a month, but it's 2 to 3 to 4 minutes at most. And our interactive phishing exercise, it might take 2 minutes for someone to understand the rubric and identifying the 6 or 7 components of an email. As they practice it and do muscle memory, it gets down to 30 seconds or less. By practicing that once a month and the video once a month, they feel like they can protect the company. They can contribute. They can do their part professionally. And they're also benefiting personally on their personal email address and their personal banking and all of the things they do there.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
Oh, you were talking about the cost. It costs so very little. Ben Franklin, when he was coming to the US, he said, with regards to fire safety, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So do this in a cybersecurity sense. Spend a little bit, a cup of coffee per employee per month, to train them on the most common attacks they face. Have them practice it, and it doesn't alienate them when you do it in a positive reinforcement way. They actually appreciate it. 70% on our phishing exercises get a thumbs up. That compares with 0% of people who like being tricked with fake email messages.
It's time to bury that old methodology. Now, I presume that you must be doing this at some scale to make it work.
Yes, we have 90,000 individual users a month being trained right now. It's all done on dedicated Docker clusters that are built for each of the managed service providers that bring us to their clients, or we have a public infrastructure where users can sign up and it's their own database, but they load their users in and we send the assignment emails to the inboxes of users. It's a passwordless system, so people don't have the headache of logging in to get their training. They just are sent a unique magic link that gets them to their training. We track it that way. And from the phishing perspective, right? The number one way companies are breached is phishing emails. We have an interactivity and an escalation path to leadership that often leads to companies with 100% compliance on every single individual completing their phishing assignment. When you think about the competitor of fake email phishing, when you send those campaigns out, Andy, the ones that you said should be stopped completely, and I agree, when you send those out, if an individual in your company does not open just to inspect it, that phishing email campaign, there is no compliance score for that person whatsoever. . 50% of your users don't open the email. They get no benefit. Even the ones that open it, I would question the benefit. It's not really teaching anything. It's measuring what they don't know. There's so many flaws in the traditional fake email phishing. The emails that we present to the end user, hyper-realistic phishing domains, so only one letter off from the vendor we're impersonating, which is not possible with fake email. You can't send an email from rnicrosoft.com. Microsoft will sue the producer of that training material. You can't use those domain names in the email system. But in our simulator, we can, because it's on a website. It's a reproduction.
Simulation of a webmail environment.
It's exactly that. Standard email client. The components of an email is the sender, the subject, the greeting, the language quality, the emotionality and urgency, the links to external websites, and the attachments. Those are 6 or 7 components of any email that you can inspect. You know, John Doe from Company X sent me an invoice today. He never does that. The sender, the subject, the greeting, everything is perfect. It's exactly as a legitimate email would look, except why am I being sent an invoice? I don't take invoices at my company. John doesn't send them, but yet today I got one from him. So you call John up and he says, don't open the email. That's a malicious link. I've been hacked, right? But you call because your spidey senses and your training, your awareness training says, if you see something suspicious, say something, call the person. Don't act on it without verifying.
Would you give us a little bit of the website?
I'll share a couple of even better things too. Anyone that wants to learn cyber literacy through CyberHoot can sign up directly for free by visiting cyberhoot.com/individuals. And we send you the full product. There's no holding back. We do it to individuals for free. There's no cost, and that's for life. If you like it and we think you will, bring it to your company and have your IT person or your MSP, sign up to resell us. Charge that for that reporting and the automation that's built in there. If you'd like a demo, just email sales@cyberhoot.com, or you can visit cyberhoot.com. That's CYBERHOOT. Just like an owl is our logo, cyberhoot.com. And you can book a meeting there. Very happy to meet with you anywhere in the world. We support 17 languages, translating our Hootfish exercises into those languages. So when you want to train in Spanish or Russian or Chinese, we can do all of that now too.
I think you've just made a very compelling ad there, Craig. High intensity training. Have you got a favorite?
Well, I did the P90X when I was unemployed about 12 years ago. Destroyed me. P90X is a series of video discs. You put them in the computer and you do a 30-minute workout or 20-minute workout.
Yes, hold on. That's a Canadian body weight regime, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, that looks really challenging. I'm a cold sea swimmer. I go down to the beach. I'll jump in, and even in the middle of winter, and I'll do like a couple of minutes. That's amazing. And then a little jog along the beach.
Sure, that's a great strategy. I think the Scandinavian culture has perfected that with the ice baths and then the sauna and then the exercise in between. I love that. That's a great...
You can get a lot out of a small amount of time. If you get those things balanced up right. Well, dude, it's been an absolute riot chatting with you, because we've gone on way over time, and we'll certainly get a lovely episode out of that, Craig.
You've been just a tremendous host, asking the penetrating questions. I really like that. Thoroughly enjoyed this, Andy. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for being a guest on The Cyber Show, Craig.
Bye, Andy. The Cyber Show.